My next guest is an actor and the author of Running With The Firm, which exposes the truth behind his experience as a young undercover police officer whose mission was to infiltrate Millwall football hooligans. For 2.5 years, in 1985, he embarked on an intense and dangerous journey into the underground world of hooliganism, where sickening levels of violence prevailed over anything else. He introduces the hardest thugs from football's most notorious gangs, tells us all about the secret police operations that were meant to bring them down, and how once you're on the inside, getting out from the mob proves to be the biggest task of all. James Bannon, you're very welcome indeed.
Hi, Miles. How are you?
Very well, very good. Now, we're talking about a time when, I mean, I think anybody who's was born in the last 10 years or even the last 15 years will kind of wonder when we talk about football hooliganism. But we're talking here about a time when football hooliganism was rife, and it was probably more important and more significant than some of the football matches.
It was prolific. Particularly 85 really was certainly in the UK, with there was the Luton riots with Millwall. They were very well documented, and the media paid specific interest to that, and then it started to escalate. And around 1987, it became a political decision that it needed to be stamped out. And the way that they looked to do that was by employing and using undercover police officers to infiltrate certain elements of football teams, certain football firms, in order to obtain evidence to effect a trial and send them to prison.
And they needed people who were young. You were just 16 when you actually entered the police force. How did you end up joining this covert team of undercover police?
I was very fortunate. I went in as a police cadet, and then 18 and a half went into the full force, and then came out when I was 19. And then I had a mentor who looked after me when I first passed out of Hendon. And he saw something in me that he thought that plainclothes work, and then eventually working as a covert officer would be good for me. And I was, I mean, at the time when I was posted to the operation, I was the youngest full-time covert police officer, and for good reason. I think I'd still the youngest. But it's something, I think, that I don't think you can be age specific. I think it's something you can either do or you can't. You sort of can't get to 40 and then people can go, well, actually, you can probably do this now. It's either something you have an ability to do or you don't. And somebody saw that in me, and at 21, I got my opportunity, and my job was, I'd done a couple of low-level drug buys for the drug squad, and somebody saw something within what I was doing that it may be good to push that out on a bigger, longer scale, and then I got selected and put onto the football operation.
Did you have any idea what you were signing up to when you started?
No, I had no idea at all. I was naive. There's certain qualities when you work and you do this. You know, you need to be a little bit arrogant, and you need to be a bit egotistical. You need a bit brave. You need to have a very, very good knowledge of the law, because obviously every decision you make will have a long-lasting effect on the operation moving forward in relation to gathering evidence and everything. But I had no idea, and the support that we received initially was beyond bad. I mean, we were expecting the Metropolitan Police to step in and maybe provide us with a little bit of documentation, like a false driving licence or a false criminal record or some bank accounts. And they gave us absolutely nothing. Nothing.
And when did you first begin to get a sense, aside from the fact that you got very little support from your superiors, when did you first begin to get a sense of what it was that you were entering into?
First night out. So, you know, it didn't take long. We went out. The first night we went out was quite an interesting night. I was very young, but I'd done my research, and the guy that I worked with was older. He was a sergeant and knew very little about football. And we went to a mill. If you're going to infiltrate Millwall football hooligans, the best way of doing that is to find some hooligans. So we went to one of their pubs, and during the evening, we started to be questioned as to who we were, because he seemed to have this innate ability to stare at people, which is not a good move when you walk into a pub for the first time, particularly a Millwall pub. And he announced to the Millwall faithful that he thought that John Fashanu was a little bit lazy and that he was white. And then as a result of that, obviously, we got assaulted and thrown out of the pub, quite rightly. And I think he then realised the enormity of what we were looking to do, and that you couldn't busk it, and that we needed to work very, very hard in order to gain their trust. And over a period of time, that's what we did.
I mean, one of the things, obviously, you had to do was you had to start researching everything about Millwall. So you would have known, for example, that Eamon Dunphy once played for Millwall.
I knew everything about Millwall. It's a bit like everything. It was my job. You know, I knew their team. I knew when they'd had good successful seasons, when they hadn't, and I'd also researched the hooligans. And I knew who they were. I knew what they looked like. I knew how they behaved. I knew who they were friends with. I knew all of that. But that doesn't. Knowing all that information doesn't make it. Sometimes makes it a little bit. Harder than you would think, with the fact that you're then volunteering stuff that people would understand. Well, how does he know that? So you have to be very, very careful. But you know, I had done my research, and I knew who the, as you say, Eamon and stuff, who the great players were. You know, the Harry Cripps, and all of that. But because it's just part of what you do. But what it comes down to in the end, it's about acceptance, and it's about being convincing, and you know, when you do this job, you can't do it from the family enclosure. You know, it just, you have to be up front, because if you're not up front, you're not getting seen, and if you're not up front, you're not seeing what's going on. So you know, with it, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, really. You have no other option other than to get involved to a point where you can see what's going on and be up the front, so that people can see that you are up the front, so they start to recognise you.
Tell us a little bit more about that Luton match, the Millwall Luton match, where there was a riot, basically. That was back in 1985. I think you watched TV footage, and that must have given you some idea of what you were up against.
I knew before. I mean, even by not watching that, you know, Millwall had and they still have, but they certainly did at that time, along with a few other clubs, you know, a notorious reputation. The thing with the Luton game is it wasn't just Millwall that were there. It was there were other clubs that had also hooligan elements that had decided to travel to that game. But it was it was violent. It was horrific. It was scary to watch. So I can imagine what it would have been like policing it. And I think that you know, the big question that was asked is that, you know, the hooligans took over for about 20 minutes. For about 20 minutes, they went onto the pitch and the police ran away because they didn't have sufficient numbers to deal with it, because they weren't ready for it. And I think that was certainly for the police at the time, it was quite a sobering thought as to what could happen. And in a way, it had a positive effect, as it highlighted what was actually going on, and then people decided that they needed to do something about it.
There are many stories of undercover police going too far, going rogue, going native, call it what you want, and forming relationships with their targets. You had a relationship with a woman called Steph. Tell us a little bit about that and why it was so difficult.
I've been brutally honest in the book. You know, it's because otherwise, what's the point in writing it? We flirted, and I think you know, all of us have, you know, have that within us, and we flirt, and there's an attraction, and there was, but it was it came to a head for me where, you know, I needed to make a decision as to what I did moving forward, and I've spoken, and there's been a lot of commentary, certainly in the last 12 months, about undercover police officers and the adoption and identity of their children and their relationships with their targets, and for me, I got to the point where it was going to go to the next level. It wasn't just about flirting and smiling and looking at each other. There was an opportunity for that to progress, and I elected not to, because and the reason for that is because it's all about justification, and for me, I could justify it. I could have easily justified it, because it would have been a very easy thing to do. You know, I needed to do this because Paul, the landlord, it was his sister-in-law, and I needed to, and I could get closer, etc. But for me, it wasn't the right thing to do. It didn't feel, you know, it wasn't right. It was morally wrong.
Because you were trying to get evidence against one of her relatives.
I was exactly what I was trying to do. But I was getting the evidence. I didn't need to use her as a tool in order to gain more evidence. I'd managed to get the evidence. There was more than sufficient evidence against his actions for there to be a prosecution at that time. And it would have been, if I pursued the relationship to the next level, i.e. rather than just flirting, it would have been for my own sexual gratification, and at that point I chose it was that I needed to stop that, because it doesn't just become about you, it's also about everyone else. And for her, the fallout would have been horrendous.
What kind of qualities, other than obviously a lot of moral and physical courage, what kind of qualities do you need to do the kind of job that you were doing?
You have to be very good at lying. You have to have an exceptionally good memory. You need to be a bit arrogant. For me, you know, you want to be centre of attention because you need people to see you and pay attention to you. And at the same point, you know, it's not an exact science. It's, you know, and it's very all consuming. It's not something that you can switch on and switch off. If you do this work and you do it well and you try to do it to the best of your ability, you can't just click off. You just have to live that life, and everyone else just has to fall into place and come along with you, or they fall away. I mean, that's just it is what it is. If you're trying to do it properly, but I think and it's really difficult to not sound sort of arrogant or self-congratulatory, but there are a number of people that can do it and do it really, really well. But it's so difficult to keep a handle on everything, because every single thing you do has a knock-on effect. If you go into that pub, if you speak to that guy, if you go to that match, everything, every time, just it starts to build and build and build. And you need to keep that third eye. You need to keep yourself that one step removed from what you're doing and keep sight of the fact that ultimately it is a job.
Tell us a bit then about the Millwall gang, the Bushwhackers, and how they actually operated, how fights were planned.
I mean, we're back where there was no, you know, it wasn't social media now. I mean, this social media and mobile phones are to a penny. I mean, at that point there wasn't that, you know, my mobile phone was, you know, the batteries were the size of two suitcases, and the phone was about the phone was a backpack. So nobody had mobile phones. So it was pretty much done by word of mouth, and phone calls to landlines, and they were organised. They were organised, and the fights were organised. And you know, firms would turn up at certain places in order to have that fight. And we were, you know, the more that we got into the inner core, the more that information was passed over. And, you know, and then it becomes about information and about having to be selective and how you pass that information on, because you can't pass absolutely everything to everybody. Otherwise, and certainly when you're dealing with, at that time, with other police forces, you would give them the information and then they would just swamp the area. Rather than sitting outside on the fringes waiting for everybody to turn up and then appear, they would just swamp it. So you constantly have that, constantly keeps happening. You keep turning up. People then start to question as to why the old Bill are there all the time. So it becomes really, really difficult about trying to explain to people that, look, this is the information, but you need to use it sparingly. You need to be outside. If they're meeting at this pub car park, you need to be four or five streets away, so that once they do meet, you can then come in and then you can affect the rests, or you can split them up, or you can do what you need to do. So you then you're then having to contend and deal with the fact that you have all this information and you pass it on, and then you're just hoping that the relevant forces deal with it in the correct way. And more often than not, they didn't.
It's not surprising that you have become an actor, because you had to create a character. Tell us about the character you created. Who was he? Who was this guy?
He was Jim from Wandsworth, and he was a painter and decorator. And he was, and a lifelong Millwall fan, which is a bit difficult when no one's ever seen you before.
of a geezer?
big geezer. I mean, it's, I was loud and brash and always had lots of money on the hip. And, one of my phrases was that I worked one day a year, which they found quite amusing. And one day a year. And I said, yeah, but, you know, it's hugely, hugely stressful, but it's very well paid. And they believe that, you know, armed robbery was what I did. And so they took that on board, which is why I always had a lot of money. My character, you try and keep as much about yourself as you can in order for it to become as easy as it can. The guy that I was working with was a really, really lovely guy, a really nice guy, but he wasn't really cut out for this sort of work. And at one point, I had to do something really extreme in order to stop the accusations, because we were accused of being police officers, and quite rightly, because he'd said something inadvertently, and they turned up to see us at a house that we were meant to be doing up as painters and decorators, and we weren't there, and obviously nobody knew us there, and so instantly they put two and two together and thought that we were possibly not who we were saying we were. And I had to, at that point, I needed to do something really, really drastic that wasn't going to criminalise me, but at the same time was going to sort of 100% make out that I wasn't a police officer. So, and I did that by electing, by playing a quiz game, and then I made out I couldn't read or write. Now, that sounds great if the operation's going to last 3, 4, 5 months, as you can probably keep that up, but the operation actually lasted 2 years, and I announced that 18 months to go. So for 18 months, I had to make out that I couldn't read or write.
Mm.
And that's a lot harder than it sounds.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But in relation to... people asked about the acting. It's probably a natural progression. It's about, you know, again, being the centre of attention and what have you. But, you know, it was like a 2-year improvisation, to be honest. Just the only outcome being is that, you know, if you got your lines wrong or you mucked up, you didn't get to do them again.
What would have happened to you had you been rumbled? I mean, are we talking about a savage beating, or are we talking about murder?
It's a really good question. I don't know if you've ever witnessed a mob, and I don't know, you know, it's. I'm sure people have,
certainly,
and you've seen how, yeah, well, there you go. It takes one punch, and then another punch, and then a kick, and then another kick. And if everybody is then aware of who you are, and there's 20, 30 people, I would say that the outcome would have been pretty bad. In fact, I would have said, yeah, I would have lost my life, but I certainly would have been, there would have been long-lasting effects for that, I'm sure.
Do you ever see any of the members of, if I can call them, the old gang, the Bushwhackers?
I bumped into one once, me being me. I was doing a film with Ewan Bremner, and he hadn't been to a football match before. And you remember at that time I was 15 stone and really, really long hair when I finished, and earrings, and I was now an actor. And I was trying to be this like sort of really athletic guy, and I'd lost all my weight, and I was really fit, and I had no hair. And I went down with you, and I said, "Look, I'll take you to Millwall, nice and quiet, it'll be fine." And one of the guys that bumped into me and recognised me instantly, and there was a little bit of a moment. They then started talking about ID because they'd watched the film, which I'd written in '95, and they'd recognised themselves from that. And then they'd been following my acting career, which I thought was really nice. And I'd done a Ken Loach film, and they'd all gone to London to see it, and said it was really, and said, and it was, and I went, "Oh, okay." And he went, "And it was really depressing." And I went, "Oh, I'm really sorry about that." And he said, "Oh, look," and there was another guy then who was one of the Millwall elite coming over, and he said, "Look, if I was you now, I'd suggest you probably leave and don't come back." And Ewan was quite keen at that point to go, so we did. And I hand on heart, I support Millwall. I always will support Millwall. They, you know, I followed them for 2 years, and at the probably, you know, one of probably their best time when they went into what was the old First Division with, you know, Teddy Sheringham and Tony Cascarino and Terry Hurlock all playing for them. And so I had, you know, although we were working, we also managed to follow a great football team at that time.
Fortunately, that's as close as you came to going native, as retaining the affiliation to Millwall. Finally, do you ever get flashbacks? Do you ever wake up in a cold sweat and think you're back there?
No, do you know, I never have. I think it's because I took the decision when the operation concluded and finished on a phone call. I mean, it's just outrageous, really, when you think about it now. 2 years of our lives, you know, running around risking our lives, and for a 30-second phone call. Oh, by the way, thanks. It's not in the public's interest to pursue a trial. You're back to Orpington driving a panda car for 6 months rehabilitation. And I'm like, well, two of my targets live in Orpington. That's, oh, you'll be all right. And I'd been given some really good advice, so I left. Flashbacks, no. It's had a huge effect on in how I live my life and how I move forward, in the fact that, you know, if you can do that sort of work, you know, as a senior officer, a really, really good, and the guy that mentored me said when the operation concluded, "Look, if you can do this and do it well, and you can do anything." So you can get, you know, you can do anything. What are you doing this? Just go and do anything. If you can convince, you know, maybe South London's finest that you're a football hooligan, I'm sure the British public will be interested in, and you can convince them that you're Henry V. And how far and how wrong he was. Richard III, you know, it's like, but it was, I'm very grateful for it. I'm proud of what I did. It was an amazing time, an extraordinary time, but it didn't become my life, to be honest. It just became part of it.
Well, one of the first things that I'm going to do is get hold of a DVD of the film ID. I haven't seen it. I'm really looking forward to seeing it, having read the book. The book is called Running With the Firm, My Double Life as an Undercover Agent by James Bannon. It's published by Ebury Press. It's priced at £14.99 in hardback, so rounder about €20. James Bannon, thank you very much for talking to us.
Cheers, Miles. Thank you.